Are there any questions before we do the today's talk? Assuming that, since this is short enough paper, probably everybody read the paper, so can we first, I mean, are there specific questions on the paper before? Yes.
There's one for the paper about the utility. At the current state, I find relax plans, and to reach the other state, the S-RAM. And now I want to consider the utility of S-RAM. And it is said that, the utility of the relax. The utility of the relax plan is the utility of the goal in S RAM minus utility of the goal in S. So I think it's we can do it better because there's some case in S I achieve some goal and after that I execute the plan and every goal there will be deleted. And after that in S RAM I achieve some new goal.
Okay.
Then there's the case that
first of all, if you're only considering relaxed plan, deletion is not possible, right? Okay. Other questions? Oh, some references, okay, yeah. I think it should be mostly obvious as to what it's being referred to, but if not, you know, if there is a specific thing, just ask me at the end of the class, and then also
if
I can.
We draw a relaxed planning graph in number two. We show how graph plan solves another problem in question three.
Okay.
So I'm not sure which planning.
Okay, I think it'll be the easiest if you just ask me directly. Okay. Yes. There is, yeah. I mean, so this is a 2004 paper, and there is. So today my prepared lecture essentially will talk also about utility interactions and how that can be handled. But this is like a paper that you read, but there's a bunch of things around it that already have been done, but still lots more needs to be done in the area. Yes, there are utility interactions between the goals are definitely relevant.
When you describe the algorithm for PST net benefit, there's a tendency to bias towards solutions that give you sub goals with no ops. So is this PST specific or could we make?
No, this is for a heuristic you're talking about, or?
No. This is when we do. I think this is for a cost propagation procedure, right?
Remember that the cost propagation procedure is only used in the heuristic.
Yeah, okay. So
do you get that? I mean,
yeah.
So of this is just for the heuristic.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, and one nice thing, I mean, as I said at the time of the heuristics lecture, I hope I said that, is that one of the nice things about keeping the base level search clean and doing all your craziness in the, you know, heuristics is you can never affect the soundness of the underlying plan. Okay, and of course, if it's not admissible, you can affect the optimality, but I mean, in general, we'll talk a little bit more about the cost propagation, and it's not at all obvious, you know, there are more than meets the eye in terms of propagating costs on the planning graph.
I guess my question sort of is, if we don't consider, I mean, this paper at least,
negative interactions are not considered in
right.
that paper at all.
Aren't we further by biasing the cost by the heuristic to consider sub goals supported by no ops? Aren't we further pushing the heuristic into inadmissibility? In the sense that.
Yeah, possibly, but I mean, the point is that first of all, this business of picking no ops, I think all you're talking about is extracting the relaxed plan. And when you extract the relaxed plan, you take lower cost actions.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, in fact, no-ops may not necessarily be the lower cost action. In fact, if anything, this is slightly better than in the past, where you would just go for a no-op, and the no-op then basically will increase your branching factor. I mean, so you'd say from this, all the no-op is saying is if it was already true in the previous level, I'll get it to you without cost. But it may well be that to make it true in the previous level, you already paid $1,000. And yeah, whereas in the cost propagation, at least this no-op will not be seen as a zero-cost action. It will be seen as okay. But having said that, the issue of what is the right cost is no less difficult than what is the right level. Right? I mean, in the sense, you know, if you want exactly the accurate level where a single literal will always be guaranteed to exist, that there is no guarantee for that, right? I mean, I hope you understand that. I mean, planning graph cannot tell you that just because a single literal is present in a particular level, that means there will be a plan to support it by that level. It's only the opposite it tells you. If a single literal is not present by a particular level, then there definitely isn't a plan to support it by that level. So all of this is anyway lower bounds. Okay, and so cost aspect would not be any easier. We'll see in particular. And you know, the only way you can get the correct cost, it turns out, for example, would be to do mutual exclusions, NRV mutual exclusions, so that you would not count, you know, costs in the wrong way. Okay. Other questions? I mean, this is a way you can. I mean, I already have some sort of a prepared lecture, but you know, if you have specific things that that you read, that you had questions about in the paper. From what?
From ALT.
ALT, you mean? No, from what?
ALT.
Oh, ALT, yeah. In fact, there is a paper after that in 2005 ICAPS by Romeo Sanchez. I'll talk a little about it, where he takes negative interactions into account. Okay. But in general, the cute thing is you can spend a lot of time improving the heuristic, taking the negative interactions into account. And also, furthermore, one of the issues that you have to realize is when you are considering the relaxed plan here, it's on the cost propagated planning graph. Okay, now you once again did a greedy extraction of the relaxed plan on the cost propagated planning graph. Okay, if there is a reason to go for optimal relaxed plans at all, it's more now than before, because in fact you're interested in getting, you know, a real lower bound, so that, you know, you are not going to be getting a plan which is highly inoptimal. Okay, now if I want optimal relaxed plans where edges have costs, what would be a technique I could use? So I'm looking for, in the planning graph, I'm looking for a subgraph that basically has sort of the lowest weight, okay, which is, you know, it's a weighted planning graph right now. Okay, and of course there is this other interaction about, you know, goals also have utilities. Okay, what would be the kind of techniques that till now that you have read, you know, one of them that you could use to solve this? I would say, since the planning graph is of length k, it's already a bounded length problem where you don't take negative interactions into account. Okay, so it's a bounded length negative interaction less planning problem where there is, you know, basically costs are non-uniform. You can write that as a IP encoding. Okay, and if you write it as an IP encoding, then you can write find me and then write the objective function to be, you know, the net benefit should be highest. Net benefit being the sum of all the goals selected minus sum of all the costs of the action selected must be highest. Okay, and that would be essentially your That would be essentially your IP encoding. Okay, and in fact, I'll talk a little about it, but one direction that this sort of work has been taking is you set up IP encodings, take LP relaxations of those IP encodings. Okay, and that, use that to compute the relax plan, rather than do procedural greedy extraction of the relax plan. Okay, and this becomes even more required when on top of everything that we already have, you also have, as somebody was asking, sub-goal utility interaction. That means if you take these two goals together, you get 7 units. Whereas if you take just this goal, you get 1 unit. If you take just this goal, you get 2 units. And you know, so there are sets of goals will have their own utilities defined over and above single goals. So now, actually, it becomes a pretty interesting issue of picking the set of goals which have the highest utility as well as lowest cost, even if you are ignoring negative interactions. And writing a procedural algorithm, you know, a greedy search for that will become hairier and hairier at some point of time. Okay, so in fact, one direction that this line of work, partial satisfaction planning, has been taking is to essentially start using integer programming encodings to extract the relaxed plan. Okay, and so that's one direct connection from something that we have looked at earlier, where we thought integer programming encodings are useless for classical planning, but they can be useful for this particular scenario. Because A, you're never going to look for, you know, if you have length k partial planning graph, you're not going to ever extend it, because you don't have any negative interactions that you're going to ever look at. Okay, and then B, of course, you may not even want to solve the entire IP relaxation, the integer programming encoding, but you may just get an LP relaxation of it. And, you know, use the fractional values, and if, say, certain actions have high fractional values, then you might assume those are the actions that you should be using. So, in fact, one idea that I will mention briefly does that exactly. So it uses the LP relaxation to figure out which actions are likely to be present in the optimal relaxed plan, and then it does a procedural scan looking for the relaxed plan. Okay, so in some sense, the good thing is that as we go from here onwards, we can keep going back to the techniques that we have looked at. While the problems change, extensions of the techniques that we looked at till now, you know, the heuristics or the learning techniques or any one of those things might wind up becoming used again and again. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I'm going to go reasonably fast on these slides. Stop me if you have specific questions on anything that I'm going too fast on. Let me also say that pretty much everything we have done, we'll do from now onwards, and in fact, I say pretty much everything we've done in this semester, but most particularly since the last 2 weeks or so, I am essentially introducing a sub area. Okay, and I am not teaching you everything in that. Okay, so if you, for example, got interested in learning techniques for planning based on the previous lecture, you know, you could actually do more work in that direction. Okay, and similarly for oversubscription planning, and similarly for everything else that we do from now on. Okay, so mostly I'll kind of introduce, and then one other good thing is that we gave a tutorial on what we currently know about oversubscription planning, partial satisfaction planning. And in fact, all those good days are getting over for me, because I had 3 tutorials that I could count on until now. There's the learning and planning technique, learning techniques for planning. We had a tutorial, so I could use those slides. And the heuristics, planning graph heuristics, I could use those slides. And then this. And then now I have no more tutorials left, so I actually have to make slides. What's interesting is that you essentially, I'll try to give you a slightly more broader overview of the area than that single paper. Okay, but you will know where the paper is coming into. So of course, this particular tutorial wound up talking about both planning and scheduling, but we haven't talked about scheduling at all in the class yet, so we would not care about, as far as you're concerned, don't care about scheduling. And also, oversubscription could happen in any type of planning problem. Until now, we are more or less looking still at deterministic planning, classical planning with instantaneous actions. That's the paper you looked at. Okay. One of the interesting things, of course, is suppose I allow numeric values. If you have numeric effects, so an action increases the water level by 15 units, and another action decreases the water level by 13 units or something. Okay, so you have the numeric state variables. Okay, or you have actions with durations, and you have goals with deadlines, so you have actual time involved. Now, clearly there is a projection of oversubscription planning onto those kinds of scenarios too. Right? So for example, if I said, get me $10,000, okay, there is a degree of satisfaction. If I give you all the $10,000, you're very happy. If I give you zero, you're kind of very unhappy. If I give you $9,000, you're not going to be too unhappy. Right? So there's a degree of satisfaction involved. Okay? So that's partial satisfaction too. Okay? And similarly, if you have durative actions and goals with deadlines, so there's metric time and goals with deadlines, one of the nicest things, and you know this in life, right, is you're always asking people, so I did not get done with my homework, so if I give you 2 days late, will I get any points? Okay, and then you're trying to figure out how exactly does the utility of the goal, deteriorate with respect to deadline. Okay, again, partial satisfaction planning. And we do this if you have multiple goals, multiple deadline sensitive goals, and you don't have enough resources to satisfy all of them by the deadline, then something has to give. Some things will be pushed. Okay, and you have to figure out, for example, which goals to push away and which goals to focus on. And you lose the utility that you could have, the dollars you could have collected for that goal by pushing it. Okay, but that's again oversubscription, right? Essentially you are only one person, and apparently you only have 24 hours, and so you have to push some things away. Okay, there is this particular tutorial. I have slides for this entire slides available, but the part I'll look at today would only be about oversubscription in instantaneous actions deterministic planning. That's it. Okay, but there, we would probably consider talking about it again when we go to durative actions, and then maybe say a little about what happens if you take, oversubscription into account. Okay, and the same thing actually can also be talked about for learning. Last class we talked about learning techniques for planning. We mostly looked at classical planning scenarios and learning techniques for that. But you could also learn for these kinds of problems. You can learn to improve oversubscription planning. Okay, so there is. I'm assuming that those combinatorics you will, work out in your mind. I would not consider all possible combinations here, but that should be kept in mind. Yes?
So, following that description that you just gave of CSP, right? Can we think of a sort of loose analogy between CSP and MDP? Okay? In that CSP, you are trying to maximize utility. In MDP, you are trying to somehow maximize probability.
So, actually, PSPs are just a special case of MDPs.
Yeah.
It's just, there is nothing, no major difference. It's just a special case. In fact, if you are looking at the PSP problem that you looked at in the paper, right, it's just a deterministic MDP with a specific reward model. Okay. The interesting thing, of course, is, and again, I haven't talked about MDPs here specifically, but some of you already know from 471, and we will talk about it more as we go forward. But one interesting problem, of course, is that MDP techniques don't have the directionality that deterministic planning guys take for granted. Okay, MDP techniques normally tend to go for full policies. Okay, and it turns out to be an overkill. In fact, in that paper, there should be some description somewhere pointing out that we did this on MDP, using some of the state-of-the-art MDP techniques, and they don't scale. Okay, so it is indeed a special case of MDPs, But then, all of this is a special case of Turing machines too. Okay, so if you have a pretty good, Turing machine, simulator, you don't need to take any courses really. But I think MDP is little higher than that. So, and it is a useful analogy to keep in mind. Okay. So we have the thing that I want to talk about is that with respect to the paper that you looked at, you essentially looked at quantitative preferences. So you essentially said all of the goals have certain costs, I mean certain utilities. Okay. In fact, if you want to use the MDP terminology, what we said utility is really reward. MDPs talk about rewards. Okay. And then actions have costs. Okay. And then one very important thing in the paper that you looked at is that the cost and the reward are in the exact same currency. Okay. That makes life simple in some ways, but it's also not particularly the only model. In fact, in some cases, you might say that I have essentially the cost and the rewards and the costs are in different incomparable units. Okay, in which case, so the difference, of course, is if they're in the same units, it becomes a single objective optimization problem, and so it's just normal optimization. If you have if you have costs in one unit and the utilities in another unit, then all you can do is talk about multi-objective optimization problem. Either you have to find a way of combining them into the same units, convert everything into dollars, okay? Or if you cannot find a way of converting them into dollars, then do multi-objective optimization. You have to consider Pareto sets, okay? We will keep that in the back of our mind. Nobody actually has looked at that. Most of the people who look at this problem try to look at single objective optimization. Okay, but keep in mind that sometimes, for example, you might say, get me as many goals as you can reach without stopping for gas on the way, and you only have so much gas. So somehow gas units are different from the reward units you're getting. Okay. Now, you can also have preference. In essence, ultimately, when you give different rewards to the goals, then what you are essentially saying is that some goals are, not all goals are created equal. Some goals are more important than others. And so somehow you prefer some plans to other plans. Okay? So in general, until now, what we looked at is we basically said all plans are essentially created equal. You start from the initial state, you do all the actions, you reach a state where all the goals are satisfied, that's the solution. Now you are saying pretty much everything is a solution. I mean, in the paper that you looked at, everything is a solution. Not doing anything is also a solution. It just has, low net benefit. Okay? So the point is that you essentially are differentiating between solutions, and somebody, the user, has preferences between solutions. When was the last time we talked about users having preferences between solutions? When was the last time we talked about users having preferences between the solutions? Are somehow the planners thinking that not all solutions are created equal? HDN planning, right? Because you can think of HDNs as grammar of preferred solutions. So while thinking about this, you can think of HDN planning essentially as a partial satisfaction planning. Okay, so the idea would then be in the way HDN planning was specified, we made it sound as if you must only bring up preferred solutions. No other solutions are allowed. But why not say that, get me a solution, but if you get me preferred solutions, you get more money. So then the parsability by HDN becomes not a hard constraint, but a soft constraint. Okay? So, one good thing, of course, is once you start thinking about partial satisfaction planning, because it's a special case, it's a general case of classical planning, you now see everything really was a partial satisfaction planning. You just made it look as if it's a hard goal problem. Okay. And then, of course, as we go and see Markov decision processes, which combine, stochastic dynamics as well as, arbitrary reward models, you'll say everything is actually an MDP. And so as we look at more and more general models, you'll start, start saying that, well, the problems that I have are all the most general ones. Okay. But it's interesting to note that HDN planning can actually be thought of as oversubscription planning too. Okay, so the preferences in HTN planning were really qualitative, sort of, right? Because they said, get me, you know, solutions that are essentially parsable by my task network. The preferences in the paper that you read are quantitative. They're essentially saying, given two plans, I'll give two numbers to each of these plans, and then it's real numbers, and then the bigger the number, the better the plan. Okay. And then now the question as to whether you should look at, I mean, so there is work on in this area on both quantitative and qualitative models. Let me see if I have a particular, I don't think I have, oh, there, oh, yeah, okay. So that sort of gives you an idea of qualitative versus quantitative preferences. We mostly look at this. But it all really depends on what kind of preferences you have available. Okay, there is a lot of, you know, there are various people who worked on the qualitative preference model doing over subscription planning. The paper that you read and mostly the discussion that I'll do here would be quantitative preference models. We'll assume that the numbers are given. Okay. So here, of course, in the qualitative preferences, you know, any plan which is not dominated by any other plan is the best plan. And in this case, especially if you have a single objective, then the one which has the highest objective function value is the best plan. Okay. Let's see. So, you know, here basically, now notice that as you go into over-subscription planning, the domain modeling effort increases, right? In addition to finding out what are the actions, now you need to find out for your users, I mean, first of all, you also have to find out what are the costs of the action. So somebody has to specify this. You can't allow planner to make up numbers. So all these numbers that I'm giving here, you know, supposedly, if you have a domain, you, the domain expert, would know what are the action costs. Sometimes maybe the domain expert also won't know, okay? As an example, for example, and so in which case, in fact, part of the issue of using the right models is to get the correct costs, okay? You may have to estimate them, okay? So for example, those of you who have done, you know, who are aware of query planning in databases, you know, you have different ways of implementing a particular query on the database, right? And there are two different query plans, and you're trying to figure out which is cheaper. And the costs depend upon essentially the size of the database, the selectivity indices, et cetera, et cetera. All of which are sort of computed for that database and that query. Okay? You don't expect people to have given it to you upfront. Okay? So in some sense, although in the rest of the talk, I'll assume, in the rest of the lecture, I'll assume that the actions have been just given these numbers, and then focus mostly on the inference problem, which is how to use these numbers to come up with the optimal plan. You shouldn't forget that as you consider this, now you are increasing the domain modeling burden now. Okay, and somebody has to give these numbers or you have to learn them. And that's an important issue. Okay, so you now have to give a cost of the actions, you also have to give utilities for the rewards for the goals. And if there are interactions between the rewards for the goals, you have to specify that too. Okay, and then of course the objective function in this case is maximize the cumulative utility minus the cost of the plan, of the action that are used in the plan. Okay. So here is one way essentially of doing it. I mean, in some sense, if you were to find the optimal solution for this, what you would have done is you would have figured out what are the optimal set of goals. So suppose this is the point. Suppose you have access to an oracle. The oracle knows the optimal plan. You can ask the oracle, can you tell me in the optimal plan what are the goals that actually get satisfied? And if the oracle tells you that, then you say, yeah, that's it. That's all I need. And now go back and take those goals as the hard goals and just do cost-based planning. Agreed? Right? So in a way, essentially the optimal plan, one, you know, is telling you two pieces of information. One is what is the best set of goals that actually get satisfied by the optimal plan, And then once you pick those goals, what is the optimal plan to support them? Okay. The second part is easy if you give the first part. But you have to figure out both as part of finding the optimal plan. Okay. So in a way, one way you could do this, of course, you know, dumb way of doing this is consider all subset of goals. There are only 2 power n subsets. Okay. Compute for each of the subsets, you know, compute the cheapest plan for each of the subsets and pick the one that is the cheapest. So, and then once you compute the cheapest plan for that subset, then the subset's utility minus the cost of that plan will give you the overall best, the net benefit for that subset. I mean, it's important to understand the dumb idea, because that's more or less what you need to do, is to do the dumb idea faster, essentially. Okay. So, you know, that's one way of doing it, picking up subsets. The question, of course, is can I compute the subset greedily without having to look at all possible subsets of goals? This is where this whole idea of selecting objectives comes in. Okay, so if you have too many things that you can do, okay, and the first aspect, first part of the problem is to decide what you are going to do, and then do the optimal ways of doing them. The problem, of course, is that they are interdependent. In fact, the optimal, you know, the overall, the way you want to pick the goals to work on depends on, obviously, how much net benefit they give. They might have very high reward, but they may actually be very hard to achieve. And so you'd wind up working on the hard things. Okay. So in a way, what you would like to do is use some sort of a heuristic estimation to figure out, for a subset of goals, how hard would the plan be to achieve that subset of goals. Okay. And, you know, we'll work on a slightly better version of that. But ultimately, that's the sort of thing. And in fact, in the context of oversubscription planning, people talk a lot about selecting objectives, and what they mean is selecting a subset of goals to work on. Okay, I realize, of course, that you could just avoid selecting the subset of goals and just directly go for the optimal plan. Make the whole thing into one big optimization problem, and then just find me the optimal plan. And then, having found the optimal plan, I will now then also find indirectly what are the sub goals you worked on. Okay, but you know, it is useful to know that there are these two phases, which are dependent, but there are those two phases. Okay. Since we talked about MDPs and integer programming formulations, actually MDPs in particular, okay, I'm not quite sure how much detail I'll go into here, because I didn't formally introduce MDPs here. But for those of you who know MDPs already, Markov Reduction Process already, this is the only detail I'll give you. And if you know them enough, you can kind of figure out that, in essence, you know, an MDP will give you rewards on states, okay, and then actions have transitions. Actions are transitioning you from one state to another state, okay. So the question, of course, is you know, finding the policy. That's what MDPs do. And what we have are actions which are not stochastic, so it's a deterministic MDP. But the states can have different, you know, rewards. Any arbitrary reward can be given, immediate reward can be given to states. So it looks like it's a model that is tailor-made as far as just being able to model our problem. Okay, given a state, you know what goals are true in that state. Assuming additive utility, which is what in some sense we are assuming, if I have G1 and G2 true, I collect the reward for G1 as well as that for G2. Right? So all I need to then do is, for every state in the MDP, if it has G1, G2, G3 true, then I give its reward to be reward of G1 plus reward of G2 plus reward of G3. Okay? So then I have specified the MDP. I know the actions already, so I have specified an MDP, and then I can use any methods for computing optimal policies for MDPs for solving this problem. There's one little trick that you need to worry about, which is that there is this issue of how many times you get to collect the reward by going through the state. So if a state has, let's say, you know, G1, G2, 2, I mean, G1 and G2 are true in a state, and G1 gives you $1, G2 gives you $2. So when you enter the state, you get $3. But what if I keep entering that state? Right? The definition of immediate reward, of course, is that anytime I enter, I get a real reward. Okay? So obviously that would kill my semantics. Okay? So I have to make sure my assumption is that all that matters is the last state that you entered. That's the only thing. In the last state, if G1 and G2 are true, you get the reward for G1 and G2. If not, you won't. Okay? To get that going in MDP, in essence, what you have to do is you have to kind of introduce an extra state variable apart from all the state variables for your domain, you know, which are basically the fluents, clear B, on A, B, all those are the fluents for the state variables. You will introduce one more variable called done. Okay, all that does is I'm done searching. Okay, now I'm ready to collect rewards. Okay, and then there is an action which essentially takes you, once you're done is true in any state, then there is an action that takes you from that state to equivalent part of that state where you get the reward. And there is no action to get back. So basically you have one MDP, you put one more MDP right on top, exactly, the same exact state, except once you are in a state here, and if you decide you don't want to do any more search, you go to the equivalent state on the top, and then you'll get the reward. Okay? This would make sense to people who thought about MDPs already, but it's just a sort of a trick which makes sure that the rewards would not be collected multiple times. And with that, if you just solve the MDP, the optimal policy of the MDP will give the optimal plan for this problem. Okay. All I can tell you is that, A, of course, this little trick that I told you doubles the size of the space. If you introduce one Boolean state variable, then you increase the state space size by a factor of 2, right? And secondly, MDP policy construction algorithms, even the best ones that were available, turn out to be an overkill. And as of the last time we checked, they don't scale at all, essentially. Yes?
Instead of adding the down variable, can I use like some weight for rewards and just decrease it like an alpha factor?
You could do that, but even that, I mean, the sense that somehow but then you have to remember, there must be somehow the weight basically is that if you keep coming, you reduce. Okay, but you need to remember that you come here. And what done is telling me is, you tell me when you're done, then I'll give you one reward, that's it. You know, you play, it's like going to a birthday party. At the end of the birthday party, you know, if you're a kid, you know, I have a kid, so I know, they give you this going away present, right? You have to tell them when you're done playing, and then they'll give you one goodies bag. Okay, and you can't just keep saying, I go to the door and get the goodie bag, come back, play again, get to the door, etc. You want to stop that, and the only way you can stop it is you decide when you are done playing. Okay, and the search algorithm, you know, once you throw that model in, then the search algorithm, the policy construction algorithms make sure that you do have the optimal policy in the space of all policies. That's for guaranteed. Okay, so the point, of course, is this is easily reducible to deterministic MDP. But the real reason that's not enough, and we'll look at the rest of the lecture, is it's slow with MDP. Okay. Then the other thing that you could do is you can just, since it's an optimization problem, and the last time we thought about optimization is with respect to, you know, integer programming formulations, convert this into an integer programming formulation. Okay, the only problem, and that actually could work, is, and it will be faster than MDP, essentially. But the problem is, the optimal integer programming formulation solution may well be horizon optimal. That means you decide the horizon, okay, and find the optimal policy. If you only get to do these many actions, these many levels of actions, what's the optimal plan you can get? Okay, so it's like horizon optimal, whereas MDPs can give you either infinite horizon or finite horizon, depending on what you want. Okay, so in some sense, these will give you the true optimal solutions. These ones are way faster, but they give it to you for a particular horizon. Okay, but it's sort of worth keeping these two in mind. Both of these are sort of useless in terms of the speed up, I mean, the scale up. Okay, they're very, very slow, but it's useful to keep in mind. And one other thing is this one comes back because we will use integer programming formulations and their relaxations as basis for heuristics later on, even though you are doing heuristic search underneath. Okay. So to do my, as I said, you know, you can always do this over subscription planning by picking the goal subset and then working on it. Okay. The question is, how do you pick the optimal goal subset up front? Okay. If I can split it into two problems, pick the optimal goal subset and then work on it. And then the optimal goal subset could be picked greedily, in the sense it won't be optimal, but you think it's better than anything picked randomly. Okay. So here is an idea that I am basically going to suggest to you, and that's more or less what is done in the first, that Alt-Alt-PS version of the planner. And what you're going to do is, for that you need like two aspects. One is, you know, in the planning graph, you're going to use the planning graph heuristic and relax plans. Okay. The one difference, of course, is you're going to propagate cars. Okay. Because your actions have cars. And so the idea would then be that, you know, instead of having a normal planning graph, you actually have, for each of the actions, you know the cost of those actions. Okay. So now, if a proposition is supported at a level, right, previously all you cared about is it's supported. There may be multiple supports. Now if it's supported in many different ways, then you would consider what is the cheapest way it got supported. Okay, so in this case it's simple enough. Suppose, let's say, is there any, I don't know, so there is no example right here, but here, unfortunately, in this level, let's say there are two actions supporting any one of these, one with cost 20 and another with cost 10. Then, you know, you'll say that the lower bound on the cost of achieving this is not 20 but 10. Because that's the cheapest way. Okay. Now, the tricky thing, of course, is it's not enough to just consider the cost of the action, but you also have to consider, to make the action applicable, you have to make its preconditions applicable. Okay. So, for example, if I get to an action, let's say, like this sample soil here, it has a cost 20, but then it also has these two as its preconditions. And you have to figure out how hard did you work to make those preconditions true. Right? And you would have done that by essentially propagating the cars. So you would have numbers saying, you know, this is 10 and let's say this is 4. And so to get this precondition, I'll need to spend 10 units of cost. And to get this, I need to spend 4 units of cost. Somehow the total cost of supporting this guy through this action is 20 plus some function of these two numbers. What function? When you're out of ideas, you try max or sum. Okay. Sum basically would assume that those two preconditions were independently achieved. So their plans have no commonality. It's not. Nothing is admissible, right? The whole thing is dead. So, but max is admissible. Max is admissible. Okay, so if you take max of each of the preconditions, it would be admissible. If you take sum, it won't be admissible. But you can do better. You can, for example, you know, given a set of preconditions, you can see, you know, the best way to do it, for example, really, is to figure out the plan, the actual plan. Because it's the commonality of the plan that will tell you whether you are, you know, multiply counting or whether you should count it only once, right? However, it turns out that what we will do actually is that we will essentially, in the forward phase when we are propagating costs, assume either you will do max or sum, one of those, okay? But then in the backward phase when you are constructing the relaxed plan, you do actually take the actual actions present in the relaxed plan and only add up their values. Okay, so the idea being, suppose now here there is have image 35, have image has cost 35 by propagation. Have soil has cost 20 by propagation. Now, having made this planning graph, suppose I really needed a plan for have soil and have image, I can greedily extract a relaxed plan from this and only add up the cost of the actions in that plan to compute the actual cost of these two goals. Do you understand what I'm saying? That would be slightly better than just adding them willy-nilly or taking max of them. So it's like a two-stage thing where the cost propagation in the first stage winds up just helping the relaxed plan extraction in the second phase. Okay? That's basically what's happening in that thing. And so now in terms of this propagation of cost, one cute thing, of course, is when you're propagating cost, when do you stop propagating? When is the graph leveled off? Remember, in the case of normal planning graphs, if you're not propagating costs, and if you don't do mutual exclusions, then, and of course, I'm also not doing mutual exclusions here. I'm still doing only positive interactions. Okay, all I need to do is I can stop as soon as between two levels, no propositions change. Okay, but now I cannot stop that way. I mean, I can basically, one of the things about these cost interactions is that the cost could reduce from one level to another level. Okay, so here you thought that approximate cost of making at gamma true is 30, but by here you think it's only 25. Cost can only reduce because essentially cheaper actions might become available as you wait around in the planning graph. Okay? Cost reduces just as mutexness reduces. Mutexness reduces from 1 to 0. Cost can reduce from infinity to finite to smaller finite values. Okay? So essentially, as you grow the thing forward, cost can keep changing. So even if, in fact, two levels have the same proposition, they may still change their cost. So you have to keep forward, you know, propagating until costs also don't change between two levels. Okay? That would be essentially like what I would say, you know, cost stop changing. That's like infinite look ahead. You know, so you keep extending the graph until nothing changes, including cost. And if you're really lazy, stop as soon as the goals have been visible in the last level. They may actually not be the cheapest way to get there, but that's where you'll stop. Okay, and then you can also do k-level look ahead, which is after you reach the goals, go k further levels. Now notice this whole thing is ad hoc, right, in the sense, how did you decide what's the right k? The issue, of course, is that if you did, for example, no look ahead or k look ahead, and you found the optimal relaxed plan in that, that would still be inadmissible. Okay, but if you want admissibility, you do infinite look ahead. I'll tell you how to get admissibility. Okay, but the informedness of the heuristic will improve significantly as you go forward because you actually are getting better estimates on the actual cost. Okay, so you have two engineering decisions already. One is how do you combine the precondition cost of an action to figure out what is the total precondition cost of the action. You can sum them, you can max them, or you can do something more complex. Okay? And similarly, where do you stop propagating the planning graph? Okay? And then that's again, you can do no look ahead, or infinite look ahead, or k look ahead. And essentially, normally, you pick some engineering decision. So in fact, I think most of the work in that one probably picks k equal to 1 or 2. So just a couple of levels deeper. Okay. Okay. So that's just to propagate the cost. If you propagated the cost, so if you imagine the following scenario, suppose I gave you a problem where the goals were essentially given. You have hard goals. There's only certain goals that you have to work on. There's no choice in the goals. But the actions are there is a non-uniform cost action, and you're trying to find the cheapest cost plan, and you want to do heuristic search, and you want to do planning graph based heuristics, and you already have figured out how relaxed plans work. This is how you're going to extend that idea. So you construct the planning graph by propagating the cost, okay, and then when you extract the relaxed plans, essentially once you know having constructed it to whatever level where you want to stop, then when you extract the relaxed plan, you essentially kind of use, so remember, once I pick these propositions, I mean, that those are the goals that I must satisfy anyway. So now I have to pick actions from the previous level. What I want to do is pick the actions that seem to be cheap. Right? That's the greedy idea. Okay? Except I'm not being too myopic. I'm not just looking at the cost of the action by itself, but the cost of getting that action to work because of the propagation. So it's not going to just pick no-ops because no-ops are cheap. No, if the no-op basically pushes the entire cost to the previous level, then its cost would not be one. I mean, its cost would not be zero. It would be the total cost of its precondition. Okay? So now the relaxed plan extraction is using these propagated costs. And you do just a greedy relaxed plan extraction, where the greedy extraction is now based on the propagated cost number. That's it. Okay? And then when you get a relaxed plan, you count the actions. I mean, you add up the cost of the actions in the relaxed plan. That gives you the cost. And then you use it wherever you want to use your heuristic. If you're doing progression planning, now for each state, you know the G value, which is the cost of actions to get to that state. And you now have the H value, G plus H. You have your heuristic going. So cost-sensitive planning is a subroutine now. You know, we didn't talk about cost-sensitive planning either before, okay? But cost-sensitive planning comes as a free subroutine. And this also teaches you, for example, how to use the same relaxed plan idea for cost-sensitive planning. Okay? Now, of course, I have all of this in front of me. My question then is, how do I use this to figure out first, in the first stage, the set of goals I should work on? And in the second stage, once I figure out which set of goals, I can use cost-sensitive planning. Okay? So the idea in the first one of the planners there, the Alt-Alt planner, is that it picks. So it turns out that in that paper, Alt-Alt happened to be a regression planner. And the SAPA thing happened to be a progression planner. That is an irrelevant difference. Okay? It's a completely irrelevant difference. Okay, the difference, the important difference between them is the, you know, one case you pick sub goals up front. In another case, you do not ever commit. You just, you know, dynamically keep, picking the sub goals. Okay, that's the difference between SAPA and Alt-Alt approach. So you could actually take the sub goal selection phase of Alt-Alt and throw it onto SAPA if you like that better. And that would then be called FFPS or, you know, SAPA PS. The forward direction, but you're picking the sub goals front. Okay. And in the other case, you're basically changing the A star search itself directly such that it keeps track of the most promising partial plan in terms of how much net benefit you accrued till now and how much net benefit you could potentially accrue from here onwards. Okay. Clearly between those two approaches, the picking sub goals up front is a more greedy approach, unless you're doing a lot of work in picking the sub-goals. If you're ignoring negative interactions, for example, which is what we do, you might pick the wrong set of sub-goals. And then you commit to them. Okay? So, basically, all you're going to do is, it's a slightly different, I mean, this is the idea that particular planner uses, and it's a reasonable idea, I believe, is you kind of, again, greedily pick the set of sub-goals that you're going to achieve. Okay? And the idea is the following. So you constructed the planning graph, and you propagated the cost, and you have everything in front of you. First thing you do is, if you're going to pick only one goal, which would be the goal you would pick? Okay? For each of the goals here, basically, pick the goal which has, you could do it one of two ways. You know, you could actually consider for each of the goals in the set, okay, try to extract the relaxed plan to support just that goal. Okay, once you extract the relaxed plan, you know the cost of supporting that goal. you know the reward for that goal. Reward minus cost is the utility of just doing working on that goal. Now you can say, well, I already know the cost. I don't need the relaxed plan. The cost numbers that have been propagated are cost already. Right? The only difference is the cost numbers that are propagated don't take into account, assuming you do some propagation, they don't take into account the positive interaction. Whereas the relaxed plan will take into account the positive interaction. Did that make sense to anybody? Okay. So the idea is that when you're going forward, you don't quite know how much commonality, how much common work you expended in making this precondition true versus this precondition true. Both are redid. But if it turns out that about seven, there are total of 10 actions between these two, seven are common, then you should only count them once. The other three, maybe one is only required for that, the other two are required for this. So those you count. Okay? So the interesting question, of course, is what we are doing is, because that's hard to do, going forward you assume independence. That's more or less, you know, instead of max versus sum, you assume sum. Assume independence going forward. And then when you are extracting the relaxed plan, you actually make up for your over-assumptions. So you take into account more of the positive interaction. So either way, you pick the cost of the goal and you take the reward minus cost of the goal, which is the net benefit just for that single goal. Okay? And you also know the relaxed plan for that goal now. Okay? Now, you have to pick the second goal. Okay? Now the question, of course, is in picking the second goal, you make the assumption that since I'm already making the first goal true, all the actions that I pick to make the first goal true are coming free. They shouldn't be counted again. It's the nickel difference, because all these other things are already hanging around for that goal. So in computing the relaxed plan for the second goal, then essentially I'll basically consider all the goals in terms of the biased relaxed plan. Previous relaxed plan was just pick the actions that are cheapest. Now pick the actions that are already picked previously for some other sub-goal. And those come zero cost. And then if they can't be used, then you start picking the cheapest actions remaining. This is just a biased relaxed plan extraction. Okay? So you're changing the cost metric dynamically, because those already became part of the goals that you picked. Okay? And then so you pick the second goal, and then do the same thing, you pick the third goal. And as you're doing this, in essence, basically normal relaxed plan extraction takes the planning graph, the goal set, and then, if it's a single goal, then the planning graph and the goal, and gives you the subgraph of the planning graph. The biased one picks the planning graph, the goal, and the selected actions that are already part of the, that have already been selected at different levels to construct, you know, to support the previously selected goals. Those come free. Okay, again, it's a greedy idea. You know, obviously, you know, it's not going to be optimal. Okay, but it would be significantly more optimal than assuming independence. Okay, by the way, this basically is going to be the residual cost. Residual cost. Okay, since the utilities are independent, then essentially the utilities don't change because of the goals that have already been selected. But if utilities have interactions between them, then you also have to consider the residual utility. Okay, just to give you a completely different example where you wind up doing the same sort of analysis, if you, you know, in search engines, if you give a single query, let's say Kampam Party, right? Not all pages, in the top 10 pages, the question is you're only going to show 10 pages. Okay, which 10 pages are you going to show? It's clear that the top page must be the one that you think is most relevant to the user, in whatever way you estimate the relevance. Estimation of relevance in search engines is the same heuristic thing as estimation here. Okay, none of them are perfect. That much is for sure. But the second page that you show is not the second most relevant page. Why? Because if in fact, suppose, you know, obviously the most important counterpart is me, so my page. And then I also put up a mirror page of my page on your machine. So then, If, in fact, I'm good for the first page, then I'm also good for the second page. I'm also good for the third page. So if I have 10 mirror pages, then all top 10 would be just mirrors to my page. That's a dumb idea. Right? I mean, even the most narcissistic person would not want to see their page, you know, shown 10 times. And if you're not me, then you clearly don't want to see my page 10 times. Okay? The important thing is the second page is not the most relevant, second most relevant page, but is the second most residually relevant page, shown the first page. That you do this. And this is exactly how, you know, if you in fact, I should be using Microsoft Search Engine, because Microsoft Search Engine for the longest time would show in the top 10 Kampham parties, most of them would be me. Whereas Google would try to introduce other Kampham parties. Okay. Clearly, I think the Google search ranking is right, because they are having diversity in the search results. And if you don't know what people are looking for, you should look, you cannot just keep giving the highest result, relevance result, but the highest residual relevance. And one way of computing it there turns out to be just getting diverse set of results. Okay? And more or less the same sort of scenarios is happening here. Remember that, in fact, in the case of Google too, since we use that, you know, in the case of search engines too, finding the best top 10 set is a much harder problem than greedily constructing the top 10 results. Okay? And the same thing here. Finding the best set of goals that have the, you know, optimal relaxed plan is harder than picking the most promising single goal, and then the most promising second goal that can go with the current goal, and the third goal that can go with the first two goals. Okay? So more or less, you do this. When you can't do the most fully optimal thing, you do this greedy thing, which takes residual relevance, in this case, residual cost and residual utility into account. In this problem, residual utility is the same as normal utility, because I said all goals have additive utilities. If on the other hand, you know, I start giving utility models for the goals where different sets of goals have different utilities, then you have to consider residual utility too. And this idea can be extended there too, in a sense. Right? Okay, that's basically the point. And so select the first goal, then you use that relaxed plan to, you know, as the bias to pick the second goal, and use the relaxed plan for these two to pick the third goal, and so on. And when do you stop? Obviously, you stop when, I mean, the one difference in Google is they only just have to show top 10 results, you know. So when they show 10, they stop. Okay. Here, you don't quite know how many sub-goals you're supposed to pick. One reasonable idea is by picking that sub-goal, I'm actually worsening the net benefit than before it. Remember that one of the nice things in oversubscription planning is the plan which achieves a superset of goals. So say plan P1 achieves G1 and G2, P2 achieves G1, G2, G3, P2 can actually be worse than P1. Because the costs are so high that the little utility you got for G3 is not able to get you out of the cost, that extra cost you spent. Okay? So the same idea, what you would do then is you stop adding goals when you can't find a goal that the best goal essentially has negative net benefit. Okay? So that's essentially what this particular little picture is showing. You know, have soil, have rock, have image were the three original goals. You consider the way this is shown, it looks as if you considered directly the propagated cost. But as I said, you could consider the relaxed plan for the individual goals and use the cost that way too. Okay? And then you take the utility minus the cost, and you get the net benefit for each of the goals. Okay? And pick the goal which has the highest value, and in this particular case, 25. Okay? And then now, of course, in the context of the relaxed plan for that, you are considering supporting have rock and have image, because those are the only two sub-goals left. And supporting have rock will get you, you know, will increase the cost to 110, utility to 110 and cost to 65, so the net benefit is 45, and similarly net benefit here is 10, and so you pick that one. Okay? And then further, when you try to extend this from have rock to extend have image here, it turns out that by your own estimate of relaxed plan, the net benefit is reducing. So you decide, I'll start with just two sub-goals. Okay, now the point is not that you cannot construct examples that will completely show this analysis to be bogus. Okay, you can construct examples where this any greedy way of picking, any greedy algorithm, you know, except in very few cases, any greedy algorithm can be defeated. Okay, but the point is, rather than just give up and say, well, that's a very hard problem, I don't quite know how to get the objectives, I'm giving you a way of using the same ideas, the relaxed plan construction ideas that you know, to pick the sub-goals that you're going to focus on. And once you pick them, then it becomes normal planning. Not normal exactly, cost-sensitive normal planning. Yes?
So this is essentially hill climbing, right? It can get stuck in local.
No, it's greedy.
Well, yeah.
It's greedy, yeah.
So it can get stuck.
It's a greedy, yeah, of course, yes. Yes. And furthermore, in fact, there are other issues. Because the relaxed plan does not take negative interactions into account, it can be very easily picking sub-goals which are actually mutually exclusive. And you get in trouble that way. Okay, once you pick, you're going to stick there. Okay, but mutually exclusive is the worst possible case. But it could also be the case that what you thought, I mean, there is interactions which make the combined achievement of the goals harder than, you know, what you thought it would be possible, because you're only taking positive interactions into account. The negative interactions increase their cost. Positive interactions reduce their combined cost, right? Now, if you're missing the negative interactions, the numbers that you're going to get here is too optimistic, because the cost should have been much higher. And so you will wind up picking, you know, significantly in optimal plans. So there is some work. I mean, this is, unfortunately, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. You can ask Romeo Sanchez, he called it Alt-Walt, I don't know why, but what he does there is he takes mutual exclusions into consideration in picking these sub-goals. Again, the ideas, I mean, you can go into the specific ideas, but it's more important to figure out where the ideas come from. And then you go and, you know, if you want to understand one specific paper, read it end to end. Okay, but the ideas here come from the same place where we were using, you know, you wanted to introduce negative interactions to improve the informedness of the heuristic, but you don't quite want to do all the mutex analysis. So, you know, you can, for example, consider penalties that are computed from the mutual exclusions, or just use the static mutexes. Okay, and then use that to at least avoid picking sub-goals that are directly going to be mutually exclusive. Okay. Again, it's better than the previous idea, but it can also be defeated. Any time you try to pick the goals that you're going to focus on before actually having achieved them, you can be wrong. There are 10,000 things you all could have done, you know, after your high school, and you know, may or may not have picked the right set of goals to focus on. Okay. You'll never know. You just will never know. Right? You have to pick some goals, because if you don't pick, then you will be thinking, you know, you just keep changing your course of action. Which comes to SAPA. SAPA doesn't want to pick some goals ever. Okay? The way it wants to do it is that why separate this objective selection from objective achievement? Why not just consider that into a single A star search? And it is possible, yes.
Well, the
complexity of the problem is the same. Okay, the real question would be, and you know, if they have to give the optimal solution, they will both have the same complexity. Okay, the question is, how fast do they give up before giving the optimal solution? Okay, so for example, if I pick Alt-Alt's way of picking sub-goals, okay, I'll quickly pick the sub-goals, and then I'll make the best plan for the wrong set of sub-goals, and I'll give you the, you know, solution. But, you know, but don't laugh. In fact, much of what happens in real life is, for example, one thing that's much more popular in, you know, in like realistic, in many practical applications is scheduling, where somebody decides what we must achieve, and you are only interested in achieving them optimally. So in fact, not even achieving. In fact, somebody decides you must do these 15 actions. And all you're trying to do is assign the resources for these actions the optimal way. Now, if you pick the wrong objectives and pick the wrong actions to support them and then optimally schedule them, do you get a badge? Well, you could get a badge, but your company will go down the drain because you are all totally inoptimal. Okay? So if you pick the wrong objectives, you pay for it. But the problem is you cannot pick the objectives without knowing the plan. So this is a problem, and we always just punt it. And so I'm just punting it automatically here. You know, in the real life, somebody picks the problem, you know, so this thing. In fact, you know, this is this ABD, Albert dissertation thing that I pointed out earlier too. You know, somebody else tells you your deadline for homework one is this, homework two is this, and then it becomes a hard sub-goal planning. Whereas if I tell you just do the right thing and get out of the school at some point of time, then that's a beautifully flexible problem, and I hope to see you 10 years from now. Okay, that's basically now, which is a harder problem. I mean, in one case, I picked the homeworks for you. And so at least you could say, well, it's not my mistake if Rao picked the wrong homeworks. If they gave me the wrong exams and I didn't learn a thing and I graduated, whose mistake is this? It's theirs. But really, if you take the entire problem, you have to also pick what you're going to focus on. So I'm not making the problem any simpler. I mean, I'm not doing anything that isn't already done in the normal real life planning. Okay. So anyway, what does SAPA do? Basically, it just uses A-star search. Okay. Now, normally in A-star search, G and H are in terms of costs. Now, the G and H should be in terms of net benefits. So G would be the net benefit of the current partial plan. Okay, and now SAPA, it makes simpler, life simpler, because SAPA is actually going forward in the space of states. It's doing progression. So at any particular point of time, it has an executable prefix of a plan. Okay, so you know what is the last state in that particular prefix. And you know exactly the actions that you did till then. So you know the net benefit of that partial plan. So you know the net benefit of the partial plan is a G value. You know that perfectly. There's no uncertainty in it. Now, the other question is, so here is SAPA. So it started, and it came up to here, right? And the G value is the utility, the combined utility of the goals in the final state minus the cost of all the edges, cumulative cost of all the edges. That's the G value. Now, what's the H value? H value is starting from this state, what is the plan with the best net benefit that you can ever get? Well, that's the heuristic. And you can do this essentially, even though, unfortunately, in that paper, SAPA winds up using a different heuristic here. You could have used the same Alt-Alt-PS heuristic. Okay, Alt-Alt-PS basically, in trying to figure out which subset of goals to actually achieve, it not only picks the sub-goals, but also picks the relaxed plan for supporting those sub-goals. So it has an estimate of, for in this particular case, it has an estimate of the best net benefit you can get starting from that state, initial state. That's a heuristic. Now, SAPA, in that particular paper, SAPA PS winds up using a slightly different heuristic. You know, what he does is he supports all the goals and starts removing some of the goals. Whereas the idea that I showed you, you add goals one by one. Okay? It doesn't make any difference. Which heuristic is better? Actually, it's not answered in that paper anyway. Okay, but the important thing is if you have some idea about figuring out how good is a state, you use that as the H value in terms of net benefit, and then you have the G value, which is also net benefit. Realized net benefit plus estimated net benefit would be the F value. That's it. You have A-star search. Okay, and then one of the nice things, of course, is you can stop it any time and give the best G value that you have found until then. Now, of course, notice that G and H, you are used to thinking of them as costs. The higher the G, the worse the plan previously. But now G and H are benefits. So the higher the G, the better the plan. This way you never actually decide which sub-goals you picked, and you can continue. Okay, but it is also possible that if you like this as much, then what you can also do is do this particular problem, you know, picking the objectives up front, finding the plan for them, and if you still have time, go back and pick the objectives less greedily and find another plan for them and see which is a better one. Okay, of course SAP of PS is more systematic version of that. It is actually keeping track of the possibilities in front. Okay, yes sir.
What's the actual difference in picking the goals of add and remove? When they remove the goals,
in fact, so this I probably should stop recording this because Min, I'm sure, is going to listen to this. But you know, I know the exact history for this paper. There were two students of mine worked on two different systems, and they wanted to submit two different papers to AAAI. They did, you know, you can't tell people not to submit two papers. You know, if they want, they do. And then the reviewers essentially said what I told them beforehand, which is, guys, combine your papers. So there is no real difference. But obviously, Min thought of one heuristic. There are multiple heuristics you can come up with. Okay, it may well be that there is a difference between selective, amnesia. So for example, how do you pick, there's this classic idea, right? Structure of neural networks. If you're trying to figure out the best neural network, that will classify a set of examples, right? You could try with a perceptron and see the best perceptron you can get. And if you still have time, consider two layers and pick the best of those and see if that's any better than the perceptron, and then go forward like that. Okay, the other one is just go ahead and train an three-layer, completely densely connected network, and then do selective brain damage, right? Which is cut some of the things. Now, which is better? Obviously, at a conceptual level, they're both very similar. And in terms of whether or not specific implementations were different, we actually did not establish that. So if you ask me, I'm the common author for both those papers. I think the big difference between SAPA-PS and ALT-ALT-PS is that not the progression versus regression at all, but whether you pick the sub-goal, and not even the heuristic, but whether you pick objectives first and set them in stone, or whether you never pick objectives. Okay, that's the big difference. And you can argue for both of them. In fact, if you don't sort of pick objectives, then you really don't know what you're supposed to be achieving. But on the other hand, if you pick the wrong objectives, you should be ready to change. Okay, so that's the bigger difference. But obviously, Romeo and Min won't agree with that. That's why there's no journal version of this paper, just for you guys to know. But the important thing is that the heuristic in OSP is trying to estimate the best net benefit you can get. And part of doing that is figuring out which subset of goals should be achieved. Now, about the last thing I want to show you, and before you go off, this is a SAPA-PS example, is you could also have utility interactions between the sub-goals. Okay, so the idea here is getting two socks, the idea that if you just have right shoe, its utility reward is low. If you just have left shoe, the reward is low. If you have both shoes, then it's priceless, very high reward. Okay, so the goal subsets might have more or less utility than the summation of their individual utilities. Okay, and when you have that, of course, the first thing you have to do is find a model in which you can describe the utility of sets of goals. Okay, there are multiple ways. One specific way essentially says, I would give the utility for G1, I'll give the utility for G2, let's say 4, G2, 5, and I'll say G1, G2, 3, and then let's say G3, 7, and G1, G3, minus 5. Now, if I have G1 alone, my utility is 4. If I have G2 alone, my utility is 5. If I have G1, G2, my utility is 4 plus 5 plus 3. That's the semantics of this particular model. Okay. And similarly, if I have G1 and G3, then my utility is 4 plus 7 minus 5. Because I have both the goals, I reduce the utility from the sum. And this model is actually called GAI, as generalized additive independence model of utility specification. You need some way of specifying the interactions. And there's a beautiful theory there in terms of different ways of specifying utilities. But the important thing for us is now, the entire discussion I did till now assumed that the goals interact only in terms of their cost. But now they also interact in terms of their utilities. Now, it turns out that the, as I was actually teaching you, I kind of realized that there, it's not hard to extend the residual goal selection algorithm to take utilities into account very easily, because essentially you take the goals that you have seen until now, right? And then in the context of that, so if you already pick G1 and you're about to pick G2, you actually get 5 plus 3 units extra. So you take that. And you already know cost, you know, to extract cost in terms of the Biot-Schlack plan. Okay. That's one way of doing it. For some weird reason, we never did this. Doe and Min and Benton, who is, should be here but wasn't here, what they wound up doing is they essentially said, we don't want to deal with these combinatorics. Okay. So he was using his idea, which was support all the goals using a relaxed plan, and now look for which sub-goals should be removed. And to do that, what he does is he essentially, in this large relaxed plan, he's looking for a sub-relaxed plan that has the highest net benefit. And he throws that as an IP problem, integer programming problem, and takes the LP relaxation of that. And that winds up doing pretty good for him with respect to his original heuristic. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, you can take utility dependencies into account too, either in terms of the original greedy algorithm, or at any point of time, you could have done this IP construction upfront, you know, even when there are no utility dependencies, and to just get the optimal relaxed plan. Okay, so I will stop here, and then more likely than not, next class we are going to talk about replanning and execution monitoring. Okay, but is any extra questions on this or any loose ends I might have to tie up, I'll bring it up. Otherwise, that's what we'll do.